Charlie Moore.
On radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and on ABC Victoria.
This morning it is all about stories, spoken stories really, in the form of letters and audio tracks. You'll hear from the women behind the Women of Letters event series, project, program, whichever way you want to describe it. There's a new collection of letters that's been released, curated by Marie Cardi and Michaela Maguay. And you'll meet Asha B. Abraham. She's come up with a new app which tells the stories of people and places in Melbourne. You take the app with you as you wander the city streets and in many ways wish that the walls or the streets could talk. My co-host this morning, the very lovely David Astor, who of course sets the cryptic crosswords for The Age as DA. Hello.
G'day, Ali.
Now, you've also, you're not just about the single word. We wouldn't like to just, you know, put you in that box. You've got this latest book. It's called Word Burger. Learn to be a champion word puzzler in 20 quick bites. Really?
Well, I thought, why don't we make it delicious and appealing to kids? That is,
And simple.
Yeah, and simple. I can be accused of telling elaborate, intricate stories. So let's get it visual. Let's make it simple. And crosswords are catchy. And I was really keen to just try and convert all those riddle lovers in the playground to become puzzle solvers.
How do you do that? You know, what are tricks of the...
Oh, smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. But if I... Okay, now this is more designed for children, yeah. But if I was to read this book, would I come out and be a crossword puzzle solver, which
you see,
I am not?
It's very crafty, really, of my publishers, because if I actually said, this is the dummy guide to crosswords...
No one would buy it.
That's not aspirational, is it? But if it's about
that's what
you...
It is. Is that the subtext?
you want to buy that book for your sparkling, bright nephew, then you can read it without cracking the spine, I hope, or buy two and put one under the tree.
Excellent sales job.
Yeah, it is. Oh, look, it really is that kind of book, but I was never intending it to be that book, but it has transpired as more adults look at it and thinking, I might read this because it does really unlock the whole private club that cryptic crosswords must seem.
Well, give us a couple. Come on, give us a little taste of a couple of bites.
Oh, well, I thought rather than talking about something like reversal clues, because reversal is one type of – there are about eight types of clues, and one type is a reversal. So rather than putting on a mortarboard and picking up my pointer stick and explaining how the clues work, I told the story of a man called Daniel Bloom, a true story. He was a journalist in Alaska who was obsessed – by these words called anonyms, they're called, words that are in reverse. So that there are many brand names that are actually reversal of actual things, like Oprah turned her production company into Harpo. In the early Count Dracula movies, his alias was Mr. Alucard. And there are, you know, lots of comical examples of people using backward words. So I told about this man called Daniel Bloom, who wished to be called Maloob Liniad, and he
was a great name. I like
that. Yeah, that's right. And he started appealing to people all around the world to send in reversed street names, reversed brand names. There's a wine company here in the Barossa called Drayton's, who realised, unfortunately, that they were Snotyard as a result of this exercise.
That's not good, is it?
But anyway, that's the thing. It's a quirky story. It's a funny story. And it does spill into the whole idea of how reversal clues work. So that's one example of the 10 or so recipes that I explore, using kind of fun kid stories to unlock the recipe.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just one. It had been one of those books that I had been meaning to write for a long time, because I had written the bona fide adult version called Puzzled, and everyone said...
And are they very different?
Oh, they are different, yeah. I mean, the other one's got, you know, really dirty bits and adult bits and...
You're a great salesman, aren't you? It's like just a little bit of
Chapter
extra.
Chapter 6, everyone, yeah, if you just want to read, do a browse.
Yeah. But it's hard because it's sort of... I'm guessing that you spend your life being asked, what is the, you know, what's the quick answer? What's the magic formula?
And the best analogy is that idea of if a Martian landed and looked at a game of chess, it would seem completely alien. But if one of the grandmasters or even just a child could explain that the horse actually is called a knight and it can move in a sequence of three small hops, and that the castle one is called a rook, and it can that is about suddenly this deep mystery becoming an engaging proposal and a new sense of fun and play.
Hmm. Same deal with crosswords. It's about breaking it down. Yeah, and making it not quite so scary as it might
appear. Well, I look at the studio, and in fact, people who aren't accustomed to a radio studio, they're very confronting places. They're so
really? Many,
but they are, because, I mean, you're not.
Sometimes I say thank you.
The empty room is imposing because of all the dials and switches and buttons. You wouldn't know where to start. And I'm looking at you, and you're sitting back there in your, you know, Starship Enterprise, looking very comfortable, because you know what all those buttons do.
No, I don't.
I hope you do.
I ignore 98% of them. It's all right. I just know that there's about 2% of buttons that really matter.
Well, you know what the important
yes,
buttons
do. Yes, no, exactly. I do understand your point that you're making.
And that's the analogy too. It's once you understand one or two ways, I'm sure by the end of the week, you will be across 97%.
Do you think?
Or at least four.
Okay. Oh, yeah, exactly. I think I'll go with the four. Now, let's talk letters.
Yes.
Because one form of letters, which is what you do, but the other form of letters, which is very much what we're going to be focusing on this morning with our guests. And it's interesting because the whole art of writing the letter, of course, versus writing the email, which is a completely different thing.
It is very different, isn't it?
Are you still a letter writer, proper letter writer?
Look, to my shame, I'm a haphazard letter writer. I used to be a regular letter writer, like a lot of people, I suppose. Particularly in the throes of passion.
Got the love letters, yeah.
I don't know if I've still got them, but I certainly remember sending, you know, more than my share and receiving beautiful letters in return.
Do people still do that? I hope so.
Well, they sex these days, don't they? It's just not the same.
No, it's not the same. You're not wrong. No.
I mean, they don't even use proper punctuation. Let's not go there. But a letter, in fact, has now become so prized that I will write a letter. In fact, when my daughter turned 18 recently, I wrote her a letter and I wrote her a poem as well. So those two things became more prized artifacts that letters once used to be, and maybe we took for granted back when they were the mainstream option.
And in fact, in the book, the collection, the Women of Letters collection of letters that we're going to talk about later, there's one from Gideon Haig who wrote one to his daughter, and it's a lovely one. So I suppose you almost keep them for more important occasions, but it is a completely different style of writing, and it's a more intimate thing. I don't know whether that's because instead of bashing something out in a keyboard, I'm thinking about a handwritten letter. Mm-hmm. There's something very special about it.
So what I agree with you, and I'm just trying to work out why that is. And I think there are two salient reasons. One is that it is for one reader only. There's not a little CC tab. So when you're writing that special letter for your daughter, you're not CCing it to, you know, Auntie Bev and everyone else in the family. It's just for you, that singular audience. That's very important. And the second thing is that it is handwritten. So it's the flow of ink through the fingers onto the page that then becomes this prized keepsake that is opened and read. The whole thing is very sensuous and very artisan, to use a kind of hipster term. When's the last time you wrote a letter?
I tend to write letters as thank you letters, I have to say, as opposed to letters of information, because I'm a relatively poor handwriter. I don't think anyone would get any information from me, whereas at least a thank you letter is not quite so difficult. And I have many friends whose children write thank you letters as well. But it's interesting that there are, you know, a couple of schools around that have, you know, periods of time or years where the kids are trying to cut back on the access to the technology and the communication with parents. These are boarding schools. Communication with parents is through letter writing. And I wholeheartedly applaud that. I think it's a fantastic thing for kids to get back in touch with.
In fact, not just boarding schools. At my daughter's school, they had a mindfulness expert coming along, and I was very cynical.
A mindfulness expert?
Yes, he came along and taught mindfulness for a few days.
Okay.
And I thought, well, great gig. You know, just live, breathe, look around. What is mindfulness? But of course, I came to realise that all of us are so hyper-connected that we multitask and we multi-slack and it's very hard to concentrate. A letter actually embodies concentration, and disconnecting, ironically, fosters communication and more kind of refined and purer thinking. So, and letter writing is part of that art.
And that's what this mindfulness was about focusing. And
It was, and actually that was the challenge for the girls, basically, to shut down their phones for a week, shut down Facebook, turn computers off. And I think letter writing was part of this, that they would write a letter to their friend and leave it with them. And the impact that that had, in the same way the thank you note has, I think it has deep impact, because it's not expected, it's thoughtful, and it has it's a personal and personal effort that that you've exercised.
How did your daughter and her friendship group cope with that? Because I'm not sure, how old is your daughter?
Well, she's just 18. She's just graduated.
So but that, that sort of teenage years, they are, if they're not Instagramming, Facebooking, blogging, Twittering, the whole kit and caboodle at the same time, usually, as they're doing their homework, and then to disconnect all of that, how was it?
Well, in the same way that, when a hard drug user is denied supply, they become distressed. And I know that might seem a cheap analogy, but it was actually quite stressful for a lot of them. And then they entered, most of them, but not all, a kind of more resigned peace with this new embargo. And I actually reckon that they were better for it. And there was, and certainly in Tess's case, Tess is she's quite old school. She's a great conversationalist. She loves board games. So there's a like a
hipster. So it wasn't such a wrench for her, probably.
No, I don't think so.
Tess, if you're listening, it's all good.
Well, a lot of these social movements. I'm thinking about things like sort of steampunk and sort of hipsterdom. A lot of them are actually a push away from new technology. I think there's
Look at vinyl.
Vinyl is a classic.
I mean, that's the classic, Back to the Future.
Yeah.
You're listening to David Aston, my co-host here on The Conversation Hour. And in just a minute, you'll meet our first guest.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Marieke Hardy, writer, broadcaster, producer, artist and regular panellist on The Book Club. Hello.
Hello.
And Michaela Maguire, who's director of the Emerging Writers Festival. And her books include Last Bets and A Story of Grief. Welcome.
Good morning.
And together you have created
a monster.
You've created a monster and you've curated the latest collection of Women of Letters.
Book six.
Is it book six?
It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's quite ridiculous.
It's got more than a life of its own.
I think monster is a good term for it now.
And they're so thick as well. I tried to line them all up for a photo to boast about how many we have, but you actually can't fit them in frame.
You just need a bigger lens.
I know you said your housemate who just moved out used one of your books to squish a spider the other day. Was it one
was
of ours?
It was not the Women of Letters book. It was
because it's hefty.
Our books are kind. Our books are kind to animals.
It was one of our contributors' books.
Oh, was it? Okay, I see.
I have to say, I know that you start this book and you start all of them by saying that you're. You've told the story of how this whole thing began so many times. The subtext being you're incredibly bored with it.
Oh, we can do it one more time.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to say, allow me to bore you, and at the risk of putting yourselves to sleep. But for those who don't, who don't completely know the story, tell us the story.
Well, I feel that it's not about us being bored with it. We're sort of staggered and overjoyed by it every time we think about it. And book six is not something we take lightly. Every time a show in Melbourne sells out, it's not something we take lightly. We're doing now monthly shows in New York. But it started, Michaela and I met at the National Young Writers Festival in 2009. And I was just finishing up Breakfast Radio and getting a life again, which was really fun. And we wanted to do an event that showcased, there were all these amazing women speaking at the festival who were not mainstream women, who probably would never have appeared on the panel or the project or anything like that, but had great stories to tell. And we thought we wanted to do an event where we could showcase women like that to a broader audience. And then I have been vegan for 7 years, so I wanted to do something that raised money for Edgar's Mission, the animal rescue shelter, which was in Kilmore, now in Lancefield. And it sort of combined the two projects in a way that I think worked quite well. So it wasn't an animal rights protest or anything. It just sort of very quietly and hopefully in a dignified fashion raised money for Edgar's Mission. Did I praise it well, Macca?
Very nice, very condensed as well.
And
you've
so that was
making it succinct.
Yes, there you go. That hopefully no one was bored. So that was March 2010. We did our first show,
and we just had our Golden Jubilee this year, so our 50th regular monthly show in Melbourne, not including the Men of Letters or People of Letters spin-offs that we do, and not counting
Sydney,
the
Brisbane, New Zealand, Tassie, Perth,
Wellington, Edinburgh, Dublin, Texas.
Yeah, Chicago. Yeah, it's kind of... How many shows did we do last year? You're the county one.
Oh, I think it was it was over 40.
Yes, in a year. So yeah. it's on average about 2 or 3 a month. So it's supposed to ostensibly be a monthly Melbourne event, but then you want to do everywhere else and keep the regular shows everywhere else and the New York show. So
that's why it's a monster.
Yeah.
It's clear. I mean, what's, I suppose, off the back of what Ellie and I were saying is that there is this real appetite for intimacy and connection that that a letter embodies. Is that something that you were surprised to discover?
We were probably surprised at the outset because, I mean, we'd never run an event before either, and we weren't sure that we... I mean, we didn't try and coerce people and say, you must tell us 5 of your darkest secrets on stage you have never told another human being in your life.
That's sort of what you're trying
but,
to do.
Yeah. No, but it just happened. I remember it was about our second or third show in, and someone said something deeply personal and emotional on stage and broke down, and we sort of went, oh, this is a thing that seems that letters seem to bring out in people. And it was then that people started asking us to podcast the events because they were sort of growing in popularity. And that was then that we made the decision to never record them. Yeah. So that intimacy, I think we're proud of a lot of things about this show. We're proud of raising money for Edgar's. But for me, the fact that we, in a society where you take photos of your food and upload it, that we put on this event for 400 people mm-hmm. with very famous people telling very big secrets sometimes. And there is that beautiful sense of, it's just in this moment. You can't go home and watch it on YouTube. It's not going to go viral.
But that brings me to a question about the book, because you say that you never corral them into having their, you know, most private and deep thoughts locked down into film or into, you know, audio, i.e. no podcast. Then why put them in a book?
Well, this is people like to publish them. You'll see it's up to anyone who wants to be in the book. That's done a letter is in the book. We never.
But couldn't you do the
back.
Same thing for a podcast? I'm not sure I get the difference between a book
because
and a podcast.
Because these are being recorded live, and everyone sort of has a year and a half to think about it if they want to put it in a book as well. And if you look at the contents page, there's 5 or 6 women who did each of those topics, and often there's only one name that actually appears in the book. There'll be 4 people who said, you know what, it was just for that afternoon, and I was really happy to do that, but I don't want it living on for posterity.
Mm.
And but it is a very nice reminder for the people who are happy to publish their letters.
And what about, there are so many big names here, and some names that I didn't know that I really have enjoyed discovering. Is it an open invitation? Do you need to sort of be... do you need to be someone, as it were?
Well, it's we like...
You're going for a bit of an invitation here.
Oh, well, no, I think you'd be fabulous. Like, we'll talk later about next year. It's October. And we work very hard to curate the events, and we've done it the same from the get-go, which is get a couple of big names, which you draw people in who might not have been to the show before, who go, oh, Judith Lucy, I know her from the telly, and they come along and see her, and we always put someone that we call the black sheep in the lineup, so
which
that
is
we
very
introduce
much
them
those
to...
type of women that we were so impressed by at the National Young Writers Festival. And they're often the favourites as well of the audience. And we'll have dozens of people coming up to us at the end to just say, oh, I didn't quite catch their name, but could you tell me who they are?
So how do you find them?
Well, Michaela's the director of the Emerging Writers Festival. If she doesn't know Emerging Writers, she's in big trouble.
But surely it shouldn't just be about people who are already in that space. Isn't it also about bringing people into the space who are not naturally going to an Emerging Writers Festival?
Oh, yes.
Like, well, I only started this job a couple of months ago, so it's not quite as... whatever it seems. But it's just something that we're both passionate about. We both really like emerging artists. There's writers that we both love who have only maybe written a couple of pieces but have never necessarily done a live performance event before or written a book or, you know, written a film.
And musicians and artists, Minna Gilligan, and we've got all these people. We've got now got Gabby Barton and Lorelei Vashti help us curate the Melbourne shows because they are the monster, you know, it keeps going. So we needed some help booking them.
But it's great having 4 brains now thinking of names as well.
And they introduce us to performance artists that we might not have known who would never really have a mainstream, and I guess our show is more mainstream now, opportunity. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of new voices and faces. Mm-hmm. So, no, you don't have to be a somebody.
But he is a somebody.
I know you are a somebody.
But I was just thinking my next-door neighbour, Steve, who you know keeps bees and is a Bosnian refugee. I think he'd be a terrific talent. But, yeah, that's the thing, too, about people we meet in the street who haven't come through the usual conduits, you know, who may have remarkable stories.
Well, I remember that TV show, was it Front Up, where he would just walk up to people on the street and the whole half hour was him drawing a story out of people, which is fabulous. Mm. Everyone does have a story. I don't know how we'd bill Steve, my next door neighbour, but I'm Steve, my next door neighbour, the beekeeper.
Bill them as, do they have to, I guess this is the thing, do people only come along to listen to someone who has a billing behind them?
Well, no, but it's also, it's not the moth. There is a distinction, I suppose. People who do our show, you can Google them. whether it's, you know, an amateur photography site or something, but we don't.
It's not Steve, the next door neighbour beekeeper. Not that I'm dismissing his story.
No,
I'm sure
not.
He does have a great story. And we do try and make it a classic kind of mix of all kinds of people, I think. And we work really hard to do that.
My other question, when you said earlier that a big name had shared a very poignant moment in one of the early shows, that made me wonder, you know, how do you actually view the material before they get on and deliver?
Very rarely. We let people know that if they want to run a draft past us or just have a phone call and sort of just chat through an idea, we're very happy to do that. But I think we might only actually find out what one person is reading for any show before the day. And then
in a show?
Normally five.
Five women.
And then it's just a case of just asking, you know, is your letter more likely to make the audience laugh or cry? So we try and space them out accordingly.
Yeah, so it's usually before the show, Michaela and I kind of touch heads and go, okay, well, let's put the comedian first because they're a stronger speaker and we know this person is saying something really sad, so we'll put them last because it would be hard to follow them. And you kind of work it around either what you know they're going to say. I mean, my favourite, well, it's hard to pick a favourite, but there's a collection in this book, because we occasionally do people of letter shows where pairs of people write a letter to each other. It's a letter to my other half, and it can be a writer and an editor or,
best,
you know, collaborators.
Or ex-lovers. Or...
And David and Kristen Williamson, David Williamson, the playwright, and his wife did our show in Sydney. And Kristen had said, we haven't told each other what we're writing. We give them 16 minutes. They get 8 minutes each. Can I speak before him? I'm going to cry. And we said, we don't want to put you right at the start of the show because that sounds a bit intense, but we'll put you last on. So she did this beautiful letter, which is in the book, and it's set in these 2 hours after David had a stroke, and she's sitting next to his stretcher in the hospital waiting for this drip to go through and this emergency medicine. And it's all her ruminating on, I wish that I hadn't made you go on all these adventure holidays. This is my fault that you're ill, and please survive this, and this is what it's meant to me. She broke down a lot when she was reading the letter. It was really emotional. And she finished and then sat down, and David got up to read his letter, and he was so overwhelmed and he was weeping, and he said, I can't read my letter. I'm sorry, Kristen. I love you. And that was the end of the show. And he's published it in the book. So unless you were at that show, you wouldn't. It was just this beautiful, raw kind of portrait of a marriage that is not in the pages, but...
And that's the alchemy of... It's like, excuse me, it's like theatre. I remember Geoffrey Rush said something like, the reason he keeps going back to the boards is because it's the sweat, it's the eyeball, it's that connection with the audience that is only of that moment.
Yes.
And you've magically combined the intimacy of a letter with the that intense kind of closeness of theatre, which... Hence its popularity, I imagine.
Yeah, it is interesting you using the word intimacy before and why people are drawn out via letter. I mean, if we haven't just said write a story to this topic, maybe it's the first person thing and that you're writing saying, I feel this and I did this.
Do you give them a topic or is it a general theme?
Yeah.
How strict are the rules? What are the rules?
We give a theme for every show.
Right.
Yeah. And we have a lot of fun coming up with the themes because we're both writers. We always think about what I would do. The one the last month at Melbourne was a letter to the thorn in my side. And Liesl Jones, the Olympic swimmer, did the pay gap, the gender pay imbalance, which was really good. We give them a topic, say it has to go for 5 to 10 minutes, but we say try and tell the truth. They're the letters that resonate the most, but we give them kind of broad sway to do whatever they like, really.
It's interesting you talked about the intersection between, you know, the writing and the reading, but I guess you might get some really good writers who are really bad performers. I mean, does that happen?
Never. No one at our show. But we get people who are very famous musicians who are so nervous they're nearly vomiting backstage. And you think, you're a rock star. You're at the big day out in front of thousands of people. But they're used to telling the truth with music behind them.
I don't think we have bad performances, more that we just have very raw, perhaps not polished performances, but that's what the audience reacts to the most. And whenever someone bursts into tears or breaks down or can't speak for 30 seconds, which happens at least once per show generally, the audience is so incredibly supportive. And it's really beautiful to see.
There was a very famous comedian who did a Men of Letters who
Where the put the comedian first rule didn't work.
Yeah, that didn't work. We thought he was going to be very funny. I won't say who it is because I don't know if we published him.
No, I don't think we did.
No, but he did a letter to his mother and he couldn't finish it. And it was, he's quite famous and funny, and everyone's like, here comes the funny guy. And it was so beautiful and unguarded. That's what was really nice about it. And he's not in the book. So Yeah.
Because he chose not to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, rubbing my hands together and being, you know, like a corporate reptile for a moment, I'm just...
Oh, okay. I'm looking at your content page, this succession of ticks that I'm trying to figure out what the code is.
No, they're the ones that I really wanted to, you know, talk about, but we may not have time. But I'm imagining what prevents someone else from seizing upon the format and going off and doing their own circus.
Kindness. Manners, yes.
But does manners wash in Amsterdam and in Lisbon?
If it happened in Amsterdam, we probably wouldn't know about it.
People ask us, which is really nice. And I guess because the show has been international now and done London and Edinburgh and Dublin and America.
I think it's also unclear whether or not Marika and I are actually involved in the shows that happen overseas because we're not physically there as well. Perhaps people think that
it is. Well, only in the New York franchise. We're not there. Yeah. We were there at all the other ones. We were doing front of house and moving tables and chairs. We were in Dublin for 24 hours. We came and did a show and left. I think we were there. I'm not quite sure. People write to us. We had people write from Berlin recently saying we'd love to do the show over here. And we said we're not quite ready to do it as a franchise yet. We're very hands-on and control freaks. We're not quite ready to give it over yet because we know exactly the things that make it work. And they were really respectful of that. We wanted them to fly us over there to do the show. And
that's also why we won't let people have it, because we just hope it'll result in
us going
overseas.
away.
I guess it's not something you can patent, really, is it? Or is it?
I don't think so. I mean, someone wrote to us recently saying, I want to do something like that. Can I do it on my own? And we said, oh, we'd prefer it if you didn't. And she said, well, how can I best do it in a way that doesn't look like I'm ripping you off? And Michaela just negotiated with her. I mean, I think someone at a Australian Writers Festival very recently did five writers doing. Did you hear about that?
I did hear about that.
Oh, a letter to a topic. Oh, it's just a fun thing about letters. And I thought, that's our show that we've done for your festival before. Yeah. So, yes. So you can do it.
So that's poor manners.
I think that I thought that was a bit poor manners because we wouldn't have minded, you know.
Had they have asked. Yeah. Mm. So that's because you mentioned the moth. I mean, that's another wonderful narrative circus that has really fired up people's involvement and imagination. And that's just to maybe listeners aren't aware of that. Do you want to just encapsulate the moth, how that works?
It's true stories told live. So that's where your beekeeper neighbour would fit in quite well.
Go, Steve.
But I saw a couple when I was in the States for a New York show this year. And it's incredible. You get the most amazing cross-section of people telling stories, like sort of quite burly-looking tradespeople show up and tell a really emotional story. And it's a podcast as well. That's, I guess, probably the main point
of differentiation. Is there room for something like that here?
Well, the moth is here now.
Mm. But is it as big as Women of Letters? I mean,
it's not a competition.
There's room for all of us here in the realm of spoken words.
It's a city of literature.
It's definitely bigger than us in the States.
Say again.
It's definitely bigger than us in the States.
Yeah.
Our host in New York, Sophia Stefanovich, has started doing quite a few of the moth shows, and she went and did one somewhere in Middle America, and she said they did... it in a theatre that seated 2,000 people that, like, the Marx Brothers had performed at, and people drove from, like, 4 hours away to come to this show on a Friday night.
But that's very much what you don't want, isn't it? Because you talk about keeping your audiences very
small. We probably wouldn't do a 2,000-seater.
No, 400 is probably our maximum, and that's what our Melbourne shows are, that sell out very quickly, and we just feel to get that back. Because we started out, Bella Union was 200?
150.
And we loved that feeling of intimacy.
That was the beginning.
Yeah, and so it was a bit of a... we thought, 400 seems to be the cap. I wouldn't want it to be at Rod Laver Arena and someone shouting about their feelings with props
with
or on the big screen.
With tinsel cannons and big fire towers.
Yeah. You've been listening to Marika Hardy and Michaela Maguire. My co-host here on The Conversation Hour is David Astle. We have just been joined by Asha B. Abraham. She's an artist and human ecologist and creator of Invisible Cities. Asha, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I was just saying before, human ecologist, it's not a job description I know of. What exactly does it involve?
Yeah, so I guess where ecology is about the relationships that make up a system, like an ecosystem, human ecology sort of puts the humans back into that picture and looks at our connections with each other, our connections with our place, like locally as well as within the wider ecosystems, and our connections with ourselves, I guess.
Which is very much what Invisible Cities is all about. Tell us about the project.
Yeah, so it's a project that looks at the relationships between people and place. It's focusing on the city of Melbourne for now. And I'm doing recordings of people telling a story about a particular place in the city that's special to them in some way, that they have a story about or a relationship with. And then I meet up with them at the site of their story and then record their story there and then embed the story at the location so that once you download the free Invisible Cities app, you can it'll tell you if you're near a story site and you can go and listen, unlock the story of... Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
I don't have a question. I just wanted to admire you because that's a beautiful artistic thing to put in the world.
But what's really interesting is how you choose the stories. So if you... And tell us about that process because these are not... people who are known. These are not people who you
Steve
can Google.
The beekeeper.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. These are just, have I got some talent for you, Asher?
So how do you come A to this the I suppose the do you choose location first, then story? Do you choose story and then how does it work?
It's the people choose their locations. So it's kind of trickled out. Like initially when I first started doing it, I was recruiting friends and then friends of friends and then, you know, people have been sharing it with their networks and then people are getting in touch with me through the Invisible Cities website. And now it's been in The Age. And so, yeah, there's just lots of...
So you've been flooded with people because if you go onto your website, you can actually click a button and say, I'd like to submit my story.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you hone them? Because it's such a personal thing. If someone's holding their little heart out to you in their hands, like how do you say... not quite for us.
I haven't yet.
Ah. World of yes.
The world of yes.
You're Optus.
I guess because the only reason I might say no to someone is because they're outside the boundaries of...
Oh, geographically is a good reason to say no. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's outside Stonington. So, no, I can't.
Exactly.
Terrific story, but not the right postcode. But what about editing? Surely that you must be able to trim and finesse the narrative.
Yeah, I edit them down till about... with the help of a friend, Janak Rogers, I help edit them down to about 4 minutes just for... attention span.
And you've interviewed them anyway, haven't you? So you've sort of controlled the storytelling process.
I actually try not to know too much about the story because most people that I'm talking to are scared of talking to a mic, uncomfortable with talking to a microphone. So I try and get it. I try and set it up so they haven't told me that much about the story. So they're telling me for the first time.
When you edit it, do you do it with I'm calling them a writer, I guess. They're a storyteller, a yarn spinner. Do you do it in collaboration with them? Or do they just hear the end product and are they okay with that?
Yeah. I try and keep a lot of it is cutting out all the ums and the, oh, can I start that bit again? And but...
that seems polite.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so I try and... Sometimes I send them to the people just to say, is that okay with you? But,
You try not to record reams of material that's then going to cause you a problem later on.
Exactly.
It's also very handy for orientating yourself because you have to you have to actually embed your own location into the app.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's a locus within the, within the sort of street grid that actually unlocks the narrative. But I was lost last night trying to find another narrative, wandering down somewhere like Foreman Lane or something like that. Ah. So I used your app actually to work out where the hell I was.
Did anyone see David wandering on the streets last night holding his phone and looking confused?
I was looking for a story,
We're all looking for a story, David, trust me.
Wearing out my shoe leather.
So tell us about some of the stories.
One of the ones I really like is by Lucy, whose story is located just outside Ding Dong Lounge. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how she was playing in a band at Ding Dong Lounge and she left there and on her way out to another bar, she encountered this hen's night and the bride was kind of straggling behind and eventually they cross paths and the bride grabs her shoulders and she stares into her eyes and she's like, I'm making a terrible mistake.
Oh, my God.
And then Lucy's just like, I don't know, sleep on it. And she's like, what do I do? And Lucy talks about how this happened 10 years ago, but Lucy still wonders, what's happened to this woman, whether the next day she went off.
Well, we all do.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I hope she doesn't download the app.
Well, I guess that to me, that's quite representative of the intention of the app. We pass strangers and have fleeting encounters with people and places, and there's these stories that they will go on to have and we won't know. You know, what
and there is
next.
The longer that you've been in a city, the more the place is imbued with memory. I mean, every corner of Melbourne to me, having grown up here, you think, well, I smooch someone there and that's where my dog and I used to walk and that, you know, it's lovely and you're drawing those little moments out.
Do you have any
people.
Locations where you've got two stories for the one?
Yes.
It'd be so interesting, like the best and the worst lives of nights of people's lives could have happened in the same place.
There was this bride who was going past Ding Dong Lounge and she ran into a girl from a van
and I thought it was really funny and strange.
Actually, at what is now the Galleria, two people have told a story of pretty similar stories of what used to be, like the old arcade that used to be at the Galleria, like in the 60s and 70s. And what they're like I guess they would have been spending their days in there at the same time, but they don't know each other. It was just describing just the significance of that site to them personally.
I'm curious about how you gravitated towards a project like this. I mean, I'm presuming you're an inveterate people watcher, but how did you become such a story collector and so fascinated by story?
I guess it's, so all of my projects, so I'm a participatory artist and all of my projects aim to create a platform of some sort to for people to share their experiences of being human. You know, different themes, different projects will have a different theme.
And why is that? Just wind it back a little further. Why is that has been your, you know, fixation?
Why are you like you are?
Who are you?
Yes.
Who are you, Asher B. Abraham?
Magical creature.
Don't leave the studio,
You've
Asher.
Got four
it's okay.
Ready, set, go. And we're going to geocache it to this little studio.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. People are fascinating, aren't they?
They are. But in your words.
Oh, gosh. I guess, I don't know. I'm just really interested in what I just like asking people questions and finding out what makes them tick and creating spaces for people to share their stories, their experiences, their ideas about life with each other.
And that's what's very what's lovely about the app. And David and I were saying that in a journalistic experience, often and in fact most of the time, the people who are the best interviews are just the people who have a story to tell. They're not the ones who are, you know, not the ones you can Google. They're just people who have amazing lives, and that's very much what your app is.
To me, it's just about just the secret. You know, it's a familiar setting, the city of Melbourne, and we're passing through it. You know, often on a day-to-day basis, but we're often so head down that you don't really notice all that's going on around us, all the secret lives of the people and places around us. So, I just kind of wanted to sort of collate some of that.
But what's your background in terms of, I mean, it is, people are fascinating, but most artists still make art all about themselves. You know, for you to turn that around and make it a mirror onto, I guess, being human, that's a bit of a journey. Have you travelled from self-made art to that?
Or? I'm not trained as an artist. I studied human ecology, or I did my master's in human ecology, and then I was working in the sustainability sector doing community engagement. And I guess I sort of shifted from wanting to, a lot of the sustainability sector is kind of about telling people what they should do, what they should think. And I kind of wanted to, I kind of felt like asking people questions was a more valuable thing to be doing, like asking them what their solutions are and what their answers are and what their ideas are. And I guess that's how I stepped into the arts. And there's been a few different projects along the way that link that a bit.
Because I was playing around with Invisible Cities last night and also this morning coming to the studio. And it is a real...
I'm so glad you didn't get lost.
No, I didn't, no. Yeah. It's a trove. I mean, there are so many beautiful stories in there. And some that actually resonate and some that don't. But what it does is actually humanises the city. And I'm thinking that would have an enormous appeal for tourists who visit a place that may seem just, you know, grey walls. But in fact, that there are these pashing corners and dog walking places. And,
said smooching, not pashing.
Oh, okay.
Is
that who you're aimed at? Who is it aimed at?
I actually, I think that it will really be of interest to tourists. But I was actually aiming towards the locals, because I think as a tourist you naturally do have a sense of curiosity and wonder about the places and the people around you. But I feel like when you're living your life and you're just getting to and from work, you kind of get a bit head down, you're staring at your phone and you just kind of, you know, getting from A to B, and I kind of wanted to create opportunities for people to pause, or encourage people to just pause on their way and, you know, look up, look around them. And I like the idea that maybe if someone's listening to the story of Lucille at the GPO steps, they'll be wondering about the stories of the strangers that are passing them.
We were talking before about being able to, or not being able to, patent women of letters. And David's right, it's great to be a tourist in your own city, but this is an idea that can and will work anywhere in the world. Are you a little bit, have you got option paralysis about where to take it next? Or are you being bombarded with offers?
I haven't been bombarded with offers yet, but I would, yeah, I think it's the sort of thing that will work. You know, every city's got its stories that give it its personality.
So You've never done it before. This is the only city you've done it in.
Yeah, I did something similar in Berlin last year, but without the app. So I made a fold-out map. Based on, like, a
very old school of paper and everything.
So I made a massive map of this neighbourhood in Berlin, wheeled it around, and got people to flag their places of significance and insignificance, and then collated all of that into a fold-out map. But
you're from Melbourne, correct?
No, I'm
what?
No, it's just that you said that this started with friends and then expanded. I mean,
yeah,
I lived here for
12 years.
Because I'm just wondering how you would, if you decide, okay, you're going to do the same thing in Sydney, God forbid. How would you start the process as a Melbourneite?
Really battle,
but you know, as a Melbourneite. But how would you start that process? How would you start to invite people? Because, you know, when you're going for a broad spectrum of stories, where would you begin?
So with this one, I started with friends, and, you know, I would probably do something similar with Sydney because
let me venture further afield. How would you start it if you were to do something like this? And or London or Jakarta or something like that.
I guess I did a fair bit of Googling of networks around the city, even in Melbourne, like looking for the multicultural hubs and, you know, the big issue and things like that. Just finding hubs of different types of people, because I wanted the app to, or the project to represent the, you know, the the diversity that is Melbourne and all the diverse stories that make up Melbourne and give it its Melbourne-ness. So I guess I would do that there as well, like, you know, start with some networks and hopefully, you know, that trickles out as well.
Because in fact it was a Calvino quote that inspired this idea, is that right?
I didn't realise that when I came up with it, I put this project together.
So it's a retro inspiration.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was using a working title that I didn't love, and then just before the project went public, I was like, what am I actually going to call this? And my eyes were drawn to my Italo Calvino book in my bookshelf, and I was flicking through it, and on the back cover I saw some scribbling that I had made, and I hadn't read the book since 2007. 2008, and the notes on the back pretty much describe the project, like talking about how we can't know the entirety of a city, we know just the layers, our own layers of it, and that it's all of these layers that make up the city, like, and this, then the idea that the city, you know, we leave these trails behind us as we pass through we leave our stories behind us, and the city holds our stories for us.
I'm just scandalised that you write in your books.
I don't know how anymore.
That was a very romantic thing that you just said, but I was quietly horrified. It's in biro. She can't even rub it out in pencil.
That's why you buy books.
Isn't that rather old-fashioned? I was always brought up to be told never to write in books, but I completely changed my mind.
No, I can't
I think they should be loved and annotated.
Oh, yeah, I spill soy sauce all over mine, but I can't bring myself to write.
I've borrowed a book from you. They are not unmolested.
No, I really destroy them, but I can't write in them because it distracts.
No, I mean, you review books. How the hell do you actually review books and not scribble?
I fold pages.
That's even worse.
It's worse for the person who borrows it. To unfold every second page.
Yeah, that's true. You'll know all the bits that I find important. Jason writes in his, but Jason on the book show, he writes in his books, and I'm always slightly scandalised then too.
I don't know, Asher, I think I'd like to buy shares in your company, because I think that there'd be every tourism authority around the world, who, all of whom are promoting walks around their cities. It's the perfect addition to that. A big thank you to our guests on The Conversation, our David Astle, my co-host, Michaela Maguire and Marieke Hardy with their new collection, Women of Letters, and Asher B. Abraham. Invisible Cities is the new app. You should look it up.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.